Our panel this morning, Daniel O'Connell is political editor with the Irish Examiner. Laura Durkin is a rheumatologist at Beaumont Hospital. And Dan O'Brien is the chief economist with the Institute of International and European Affairs. And good morning, everybody, and you're welcome. Now, Danny, this is like it was kind of the front pages of the papers yesterday. It's front pages again today. Can you just tell us, just give people in a nutshell what's going on here between NPHET and the government, please?
Where do you start and where do you finish, Brendan? It's an unholy mess. I mean, when you see a government having to call an emergency cabinet subcommittee on 11 o'clock on a Friday morning and then an emergency cabinet meeting, full meeting of the cabinet at 3 o'clock on a Friday when most of the cabinet ministers are out of Dublin.
No, I understand that my very firm understanding is that that cabinet meeting was planned. It
Not wasn't, at all.
They weren't bounced into
Not
it.
Not at all. I've spoken to several ministers who give me a very different view. I'm fairly sure
that was planned. And Leo Varadkar also did say we will deal with this before the letter came out. He said we'll deal with it quickly.
Even Helen McEntee was on Morning Ireland saying she wasn't aware of a cabinet meeting being called for that day. So, I mean, there may have been plans for a cabinet subcommittee, but certainly not a cabinet meeting.
Okay.
And certainly when half the cabinet are dialing in online rather than being there in person, it does go to show that kind of this was being sort of made up on the hoof. The very clear intention was the NPHET letter had leaked on Thursday night. They couldn't let it drift.
An NPHET letter was coming. We can go back and forth.
Yeah,
they knew an NPHET letter was coming.
They didn't plan to leak, but they did plan to deal with it quickly.
But what they didn't want to do is leak and have
a weekend of speculation and kind of it might be this, it might be that, and all the rest of it. But what you have had over the last 7 days is catastrophic U-turns, miscommunication, droppings of the ball, gaffes, ministerial.
Really catastrophic?
Well, like when you look at people who were caught in Heathrow Airport, Munich Airport, about PCR testing, whether they needed it on Friday morning or not, scrambling to try and get this, and then only to be told, as an aside on morning radio, that it's not now needed until Sunday because they had no form of communication. When principals around the country are being given less than 17 hours notice about the need for mask wearing the following day, that is catastrophic in my view.
Is it catastrophic, do we think, guys, or is it just people scrambling to try and deal with an emerging situation? Laura?
I'd say some of it is, you know, life is hard. It's a pandemic and I think everyone is doing their best. But I don't think I do think the communication should have been clearer and should have been better.
OK, anyway, look, catastrophic or not, where has it left us now?
Well, we're left in a situation where ministers feel very aggrieved around the political manoeuvrings, as they see it, of NPHET. And you see NPHET feeling very aggrieved that they're now being villainised by the political class, essentially, before the mess that we find ourselves in.
So both sides are feeling archery, so it has echoes
of, remember that big falling out between NPHET and government last year when Leo Varadkar went on and threw Tony Holland under the bus? It has echoes of the sort of tensions there. You know, when cabinet are taking a decision to kind of bring communications all under one guise of the government buildings, essentially, like that, it goes to show that they're unhappy with how things are being communicated. I think there's been a long-standing frustration that you have individual members of NPHET coming on the airwaves and articulating a view that may not necessarily be government policy, but may have this impact of ramping up expectations and ramping up...
And like Mark Tighe mentioned that situation that occurred during the week where NPHET had said something about... had said basically, cut out all your kids' interactions. The Minister for Health went on prime time on Tuesday night, and said, no, cut them down, like, and said one panto this week. And the next day...
A letter was being kind of delivered to principals and parents all over the country, like.
From Tony Holland. Yeah.
So you do have this mismatch and I think this has been a problem, and I've been a critic of this. Like, I mean, ultimately, there may have been a need in the early stages of the pandemic to give medics this platform, this daily platform to articulate a view. But when we're very much now in a political realm, there has to be a clear line of communication. The government and the state needs to speak with one voice. Otherwise, you get this chaos, and that's what's happened.
Okay, Dan, you're nodding.
Governments have economic advisors, political advisors, legal advisors, media advisors. We don't know those people. They are backroom people. And in normal times, advisors are in the background. We don't have the Attorney General popping up on your show or in the media giving opinions on things. As Danny said, at the onset of this emergency, it wasn't a crisis, it was an emergency, it was right and proper that senior medical people were visible to reassure the public. We are not in an emergency now. This is now endemic.
Are we not in an emergency anymore? This is endemic now.
Okay, all of the metrics are not nearly as bad as they were in previous waves. We've all been vaccinated, and we are going to have to live with this. It's not going to be vaccinated away. It's not going to be ventilated away. This is the new normal. It is past time for the advisors on the medical side to be put back in their box and for the government to make decisions. It should have happened a long time ago, and the government is to blame for not getting a grip on this and saying our advisors should be backroom people, all advisors, and that should have happened a long time ago.
But you see, okay, but like I think a lot of people might be uncomfortable with this portrayal of these doctors who presumably have taken a Hippocratic oath to do no harm. They're trying to save lives. They're trying to act in the best interests of public health. And they're being portrayed as kind of political, as, you know, egomaniacs, power crazed, all this kind of thing. Maybe they're just doctors trying to do the right thing.
Well, could I also say that the incentives they face in terms of shutting things down, they have really no incentive to be think about other things. That's the government's job. They have an incentive to say, let's shut everything down, because if we don't and it turns out worse than we expected, then, you know, we could get the blame. So it's in our interest to say, do the maximum all the time. But government has to weigh up other factors as well. So that is why I think they should be in the background providing advice.
So we hear nothing until the government speaks.
That's how it is with our economic advisors, our legal advisors, political advisors, their backroom people.
Laura.
So I suppose there's two different things there, isn't there? So the first is that NPHET appears to be a leaky cauldron, and you would wonder whether or not at this point it's a little bit maybe large and unwieldy, and maybe it's difficult to get control of such a big group of people.
Sure, every second person who turns up on the radio now seems to be a member of NPHET.
So you would wonder whether or not that big a team can ever be truly cohesive. And I suppose the second thing about, I suppose, just speaking with my purely medical hat on, is that, you know, there is, the medical council guidelines are really clear on it, that if you see, and I'm not talking about a deficit in care or something that impacts your patients in a negative way, that you have a moral obligation to speak out in that regard. Now, I think for public health, obviously, everyone can be considered their patients. They are the doctors of the public. So I do think there is a certain moral obligation on behalf of some of them to you know, communicate if they see a problem. Now, I do also agree at the same time that I don't think NPHET and the government headbutting each other in some, like, you know, silverback gorilla, testosterone-fueled argy-bargy is beneficial to anybody. And I do think that they should have cohesive messaging.
When you say testosterone fuel there, are you making a subtle reference to the fact that it's mainly men involved in all this?
Would I dream of it? So, yes, absolutely. So this to me speaks of, you know, big egos in a room that are bashing off each other in ways that are unnecessary. And I think they could all work very cohesively and well together, and probably should. So, yes.
And to add to that, Brendan, just to know, look, I mean, people sometimes forget that the Minister for Health and the Chief Medical Officer work three doors away from each other. And a lot of people in government repeatedly say to me, clearly, that there's something going on in that dynamic. They're either not talking, they're not getting on, because the lines of communication simply aren't as where they should be.
Yeah, you see this stuff in the Mail today, where they're suggesting that, you know, that Tony Holland's like the Pope with this letter, which is like the Ten Commandments. This is some unknown source saying this. But apparently, when Simon Harris was the Minister for Health, him and Tony Holohan would have a conversation first. The cabinet would be briefed. Is that how it
worked? By Harris rather than Tony Holohan.
And then the letter would come. So they knew, is that correct?
That would be the sense that what was happening in the early stages of the pandemic, that there was a need to sort of escalate this politically quicker than, say, it getting out or leaking out or whatever like that. And that does not seem to be happening at the moment.
Okay. And Danny, what's the sense of Leo Varadkar in all of this? Like, he started his speech at the press conference the other night by saying basically it's very hard to explain why we're having these restrictions at the moment or something. It's very hard for me to explain it to you, and it's hard to see and stuff. But then he went on to say, kind of say, I am fully behind these. But today we see...
But you see it across the papers today and yesterday, a very clear attempt, not only by Leo Varadkar, but by Fine Gael, I think, to say, we're doing this to sort of gritted teeth, if you know what I mean. We're kind of going along with this, but we're politically saying we've had enough of this. The rationale for this is somewhat questionable, but I think they're looking at last Christmas and saying we don't want to take the risk of going against NPHET now at this stage and pay the price for it in January or February.
Is that back to your point, Dan, about that the incentive here is to be overly cautious, and is that the government is, while Leo Varadkar is out saying we can't be overly cautious all the time, would you say they're being overly cautious now because they got badly burnt last year?
Well, the new variant raises issues that we don't know about. And I think, you know, some restrictions do pass the proportionality test. You know, is it proportionate to take extra caution now when we don't know enough? And Laura, we were talking earlier, Laura knows about, you know, how much time it'll take for it to become clear how dangerous this is. One thing I would say is I'm, you know, very reluctant to go down the route of restrictions. As I say, this probably passes the proportionality test. But if it comes clear in the next few days or weeks that this is not any more serious than previous variants, then those restrictions imposed should be immediately lifted. Not wait. We don't wait till January. We lift them immediately. They're only proportionate because there's uncertainty now.
You're nodding along with that, Laura, yeah?
I think that, you know, we are a little bit haunted by the spirits of Christmas past. And I think we are also very limited, let's be honest, by the capacity within our healthcare service. And I know everyone is sick of hearing that, but that is why we have to be so conservative, because we don't have the ICU beds and we don't have the hospital beds. And at the moment we have, 30% of our ICU beds have, you know, COVID patients in them. And COVID is a long road. You get into you're in an ICU with COVID, you're there for weeks. So that's blocking up things. You know, I suppose we don't have that flexibility, but absolutely, if it turns out that patients in South Africa who have this new variant are not getting sick, if we come back, if that information becomes clear, then absolutely we need to be kind of fast on our feet and look at whether or not we can pull back on our restrictions and change things. And just be quick and agile and sensible.
Because I think there's a sense that, like, you know, locking down has been the sole kind of default mechanism that we have, and it's not a zero cost solution. I mean, there's a real cost to all of this. And ultimately as well, I think, you know, when you see, I think a lot of people are getting frustrated by the fact that, you know, 18 months into this or 20 months, whatever it is, record spending in the health service, the tangible structural gains in terms of extra ICU beds and all the rest simply have not
materialized. Well, there are extra ICU beds.
But Brendan, they're marginal compared to what
they are. There 800 to 1,000 extra beds in the whole system in the last year? Look, I'm open to correction on that, but I think in fairness, the assertion is made a lot by the opposition that there are no extra beds, but that's not entirely true.
We went in with this with about 250, we're up to roughly about 300 ICU beds.
Yeah.
$4 billion extra over the last 18 months. Is that money well spent, or should there not be more?
And I'm not a government spokesman, but as far as I understand, isn't there a plan that they're gradually building them? You need to staff them, you need the expertise, and you need to build them, and they have but where we land is there are 50 more than there were.
And there should be more.
Okay.
I suppose the fact that, to Laura's point, the fact that we don't have more means that we're enforcing restrictions on people, we're closing businesses, and we're restricting people's lives.
Yeah.
22 months later.
Yeah. Okay. We'll take some, Laura, in deference to your own expertise, we'll take some more expertise, specific expertise now. So if you put on your headphones, Gerald Barry, Assistant Professor in Virology in UCD, joins us. Gerald, good morning.
Morning, Brendan. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. So listen, there's a lot of moving parts here, right? So one thing is the travel measures that Danny was alluding to earlier, they are coming in today now, eventually.
Hopefully.
You were saying on Twitter on Monday, you're quite strong about this, using one-off antigen tests to stop COVID coming into Ireland is scientifically unsound. Whoever came up with it should have a look at themselves. I'm embarrassed for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably written in a moment among many moments of huge frustration at the moment, Brendan, to be honest. But yeah, like, basically I looked at what they're proposing, which is a PCR within 72 hours of flying or an antigen test within 48 hours of flying. And you know, if the ultimate the aim of this whole thing is to dramatically reduce the amount of Omicron variant coming into the country, I mean, you know, to put it simply, the science does not support doing either of those things to have a massive impact on our importation of this variant into the country. I mean, if you just take antigen testing, for example, like, I'm a huge fan of antigen testing. I think we should be using it much more widely in the country, but it has to be used appropriately. And using it as a once-off test 48 hours before a flight and no other follow-up is, I mean, it's not quite pointless, but it's not far off pointless.
So this is ironic, isn't it, that the people who were telling us for the last 2 years that we couldn't use antigen tests because we wouldn't use them in the right circumstances and for the right reasons are now recommending that we use antigen tests, and you're pointing out that this is not the right way to use antigen tests.
Yes. I mean, ironic would be a mild way of describing it, to be honest.
Okay, okay. Listen, Gerald, I think your broader picture here on things at the moment is that we have slightly lost control of where COVID is at in the community, and that is unnecessary.
Yeah, I think there's two issues going on here. There's no doubt the Omicron variant is a huge issue, but we can't ignore that. The data coming out of Africa at the moment is troubling, very troubling to say the least.
How troubled are you?
But I mean, you just have to look at the preliminary data coming out, and there's been anecdotal suggestions that it's causing a milder disease, but I think we have to be very cautious interpreting that based on what we're seeing. But the other two key points that have come out is, one, you're less protected from reinfection with this variant. And the other thing is the R value. So in the previous wave in South Africa, when they went from a very low base to really high cases, they saw an R number, and we're all familiar with this R number again, of about 1.5. Currently, what they're seeing in Africa, South Africa, is an R number of 3 or over 3.
I've heard 3.5 was mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's, it seems to be simply down to the change in variant. They can't pinpoint anything other than that's driving that. So, you know, so you take those two things, less protection against infection, and an increased transmission rate. I have to caveat that by saying this is very preliminary data, but based on those two things alone, if you drop this variant into a country like ours, where we're running at between 4,000 and 5,000 cases a day, and effectively don't seem to be able to drive that much lower with what we're currently doing, you know, that's a very worrying scenario, because if everything else remains equal, that case number is going to shoot up with the Omicron variant based on what we currently know. And that's not to drive any kind of fear among people. That's just, unfortunately, the reality based on the evidence we have. So, like, I get so frustrated over the last week, and I think scientists across the country looking from the outside in are tearing their hair out at this, because it just feels like we're going into this cycle that, you know, we were back in October last year, in January last year, in December last year.
The rest of Europe is as well, aren't they?
To an extent, not all of Europe, though. Like, I mean, yes, cases are increasing, but I mean, if you look at, I mean, Denmark is just a great example of it. Yes, their cases have increased, but everything is still open. Mask wearing in an awful lot of places is optional. The main thing they have is their COVID pass, and their testing rate is through the roof compared to ours. They're testing currently about 190,000 people by PCR a day, and over 200,000 people by antigen test a day, compared to us doing 220,000 PCRs in a week. And so what
would they have a comparable population to us? They would,
Yeah, it's about, I think, about 5.5 million, 6 million maybe. So it's not far off. Like, I mean, it's a little bit more, but it's basically comparable. Yeah. And so what they have is a comprehensive view of who's infected in the country, whereas we do not. Yeah, we are under-testing our population. We don't know where transmissions are coming from or going to. And in that scenario, you can't control anything without introducing further and further restrictions.
It's unbelievable that we're harking back 2 years on to the first thing we were ever told about this by the great Mike Ryan at the time, was like, test, wasn't it? The WHO
It should be the cornerstone. Like, I think the ultimate frustration for a lot of people in the country is that, you know, we're introducing restrictions again to try and curb this thing, when there are so many other public health measures we could be taking to support the amazing work that public health is already doing, and to supplement it and drive it up. And, you know,
in a nutshell, what are we not doing?
Well, I mean, we need to multiply our testing by a factor of probably about 5. Okay. We need to contact trace in all situations, including schools, much better. So we need to ramp up the amount of contact tracers we have. We need to be sequencing a whole lot more. We're only sequencing about 10% of our cases.
Yeah, no, I know Killian DeGaskin would say that is the amount you sequence in order to get a picture. That is the recommended statistical amount you do, that we're doing enough.
So again, Denmark is sequencing 90% of their cases. And what you can do when you get up to that level of cases is you can use sequencing to track chains of transmission. So like a fingerprint, you can track the virus between people. So you get rid of the idea, or you reduce an awful lot the idea of community transmission, which is this idea of we don't know where it came from. And instead, you can use the fingerprint of the virus to track it through the population.
Okay. Will you stay with us, Gerald? And we're going to go through, there's a couple of other issues here, and just we'll keep you here and don't be afraid to chip in. Danny, there's a poll in the Sunday Independent today, and it's their front page, public mood turns against unvaccinated. So can you just give us that poll in a nutshell, what it's saying?
Yeah, sure. So the majority of 57%, I think, is the figure. It basically says that 56%, that people who are unvaccinated should pay a penalty or should be penalised or should be restricted in terms of society.
And that's versus, that now is versus 32% against.
Yeah, I'm just going to
get the
file open here.
It's not 56-44, it's kind of more closer to 2-1.
Let me just get the actual phrasing of it here. So it's 56% overall say those who have not taken a vaccine should face travel restrictions, workplace bans, and a view that increases to 63% amongst fully vaccinated and 69% of older people. And as you say, it's not a straight kind of either or, there's a kind of a mixed view in the middle.
Okay, what do you think?
Yeah, like it's very difficult, I suppose, when you're being beaten over the head and being told on a daily basis that a large proportion of people in ICU beds are
beating us over the head. They're the facts, aren't they?
They are, but I suppose, again, it's the nature of how it's been communicated again and again and again. And I think it's a very valid message. I'm not saying I disagree, but I think it's a very valid message. And I do think, what my point being is that if you had asked that poll 5 or 6 months ago, I don't think you would have gotten that number at all. I think it would have been a much more benign figure.
Yeah.
I think on foot of...
hardening.
Again, if you're heading back into another prolonged period of restrictions, like if we were in an unrestricted zone and everyone had their freedoms and we could all move around, this would be a non-issue. The fact we're heading back into restrictions and people's lives are being affected in terms of livelihoods, etc., like that, people like to blame other people. And
we're ordering the unvaccinated. Laura, you're nodding there. Like you're seeing it from a particular. Well, you're going back into work shortly. You've been off for the last year, but you're seeing it from a particular point of view. You and your colleagues. How do you feel about the unvaccinated?
So if you look at 7% of 50% of the ICU of the hospitalizations are amongst the unvaccinated. So we say, you know, we can hit them over the head and make them feel terrible about it. Mm. We can make them harden their stances so they're never vaccinated, so they will never be vaccinated. Or we can look at why particular groups of people are not being vaccinated. Mm. And I suppose if you look at the groups, there's people who grew up in oppressive communist regimes. So if you grew up where the state was not, where the state was controlling your actions, in my experience, people from those countries, the Eastern Bloc, they're very slow to be vaccinated. And I think even in their home countries, the vaccination rates tend to be quite low.
Yeah.
You know, the messaging around like pregnant people, they're the second group that, you know, they have had at the very mixed messaging around vaccination in pregnancy. Obviously, I'm going to say this loud and clear. Every pregnant woman should go and get a vaccine if they haven't had one. COVID in pregnancy is absolutely horrendous. And then we have things like, you know, people who are genuinely mistrusting of the state or mistrusting of medicine. And that's something that we need to work a little bit harder on. I think that we will probably have to bring in further restrictions for unvaccinated people, but that's not going to turn them. I think what's going to turn them is how we deal with them and address their specific issues and concerns.
Yeah. I see even in Germany, I think their state security kind of apparatus or something has said to the German government, if you mandate vaccination for everybody, it's only going to harden the position among these people. Dan?
Yeah, I think it's nuanced that people, for example, in healthcare settings, it seems to me that mandatory people, you know, because of the risk of infecting people you're being paid to care for. So I think there could be a tougher stance there. But I think it does have to be nuanced, the idea that you know, what are you going to do? Tie people down and inject them? You know, mandatory, that's a route I wouldn't go down for a whole range of reasons. So I think there are carrots that can be used. There are some sticks, but I think different contexts require different positions.
But equally now, Gerald, there are people texting in saying we are in the position we're in because these people aren't vaccinated, because we would not, the ICU would not be in the position it's in. Therefore, that's kicking back to everything else that we're having to do here and to these restrictions again.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt unvaccinated people are disproportionately contributing to things like hospitalisation. But I mean, ultimately, we're in this position because there's so much damn virus in the country. You know, that's the root of the whole problem. And I mean, you know, I really don't feel comfortable with the idea of mandating vaccination. I mean, you know, if you just look back to the smallpox campaign that was rolled out back in the 50s and 60s, you know, there's stories of, I looked at a really interesting webinar during the week. They talked about vaccination in Africa for the smallpox campaign and how armies used to roll into villages and literally chase people into the woods with needles to try and get a vaccine into their arm. And they found it just doesn't work because people harden against it and actually grow, you know, angry against it. And so what you have to do is you have to communicate with these people, you have to contact them, you have to explain to them endlessly and get community leaders involved, get people on board with something rather than forcing them into it. And you know, you're not going to be able to vaccinate everyone. In fact, the level of vaccination we have in this country really is phenomenal if you think about it. So, you know, I think all that has to happen about getting down to somebody's level, explaining why it's a good idea constantly, but also at the same time, reducing virus in the country overall will have a greater impact. Yeah, you know, we can't point the finger at a certain population and blame them for all our problems. We need to stop blaming the population and start to look at national policies that are ultimately leading to this huge level of virus in the country. Because, if we continuously blame the population, as you can see, people will just grow bored, tired, frustrated, and compliance overall will start to reduce. And we're not going to continuously be able to do this.
Okay. Gerald, did you read the piece with Gerry Killeen in the Mirror today?
No, I didn't. I didn't see that, read the headline.
Yeah. So what he's saying is, in a nutshell, he says that, like, people are outsupping points and that this is putting schools in jeopardy. I mean, he's making the point that I think everybody kind of agrees with. It's the schools are the last resort that we want to protect in lots of ways. So he's saying close pubs and restaurants for now when there's this level of people in ICU and there's this level of COVID around, and that the thing we should be preserving is keeping schools open.
I mean, I think, I think he has a very fair point to an extent, in the sense that how can you turn around and tell a child they can't go to a birthday party as you head out to the pub or the restaurant? You know, it just doesn't seem to make sense, especially when we know that adults drive this, you know, to a great extent. We know that adults can transmit this really, really well in indoor environments that are not managed properly. You know, like, I think this just points to an overarching problem across the country and how we're, you know, dealing with this virus in general. Whether I would shut restaurants and pubs, I don't think I agree with that, to be honest. I would be much more inclined to say, you know, put filtration and good ventilation into every pub, require and mandate and inspect
places. Because, like, we were talking to Rory O'Neill yesterday, and he's basically saying that they got no communication, no kind of advice about it or anything, and it doesn't count for anything in terms of public health or anything. The fact that he has put in fantastic ventilation, but it doesn't make any difference at all.
I think this is a huge problem, Brendan. Like, some places are going to huge lengths to improve the quality of the air in there and the distancing in their restaurant or the pub, and there's no benefit to it. Why can we not have a system where we have inspectors going around checking places, and if they meet a really high standard, then they are approved, and people know that they're approved places, and they're rewarded by, for example, maybe extended hours, or they're allowed to open and other places aren't allowed to open. Like, I think we have to be a bit harder on this and not kind of, you know, in a wishy-washy way, give recommendations, you know, and that goes for an awful lot of things. Like, just to say one more thing on antigen testing, if I could, Micheál Martin made a kind of a throwaway comment on Friday, about people using antigen testing before a wedding, I think. Anecdotally, he had heard that some people are doing this. You know, that's a classic example of something that he clearly thinks is a good idea because he kind of mentioned it as something. Why do we not have a policy around that? Yeah. Why are we not saying, in a risky environment, don't go until you use an antigen test? And if you get a positive, you don't go. Like,
it's not going to be perfect, but at the same time, it would catch some. Dan, you wanted to come in on this.
Just to emphasize this disease with kids. You know, as a parent, I would not do anything to put my child at risk. But the risks are absolutely minuscule. There is not a single child under 14 who has died in this country. Almost none. And I stand to be corrected by the doctor. You know, this the disease for kids, it is just, in terms of the share going into hospital, ICU, this is an older person's disease. Yeah. It is.
I think we believe, you know, there has been. I think we believe there, that possibly factually we think there is a child under 14.
The last time I saw it was 14 was the youngest. The range was from 14 to 105 years of age.
Okay. Laura, do you know if that's correct? Because I think we have a reason to believe that might not be correct.
There have been small numbers of children with severe disease, but one of the huge things that they've had in paediatrics this year has actually been an explosion in other non-COVID viruses. So RSV has been horrendous this year. It's been a truly awful year for respiratory viruses in the paediatric population. And I think as a reflection of the fact that they weren't exposed last year.
Yeah.
So they've been totally overrun.
Yeah. Okay, but I think that's not to Dan's point. Look, Danny's showing me there, 14 is the youngest. So look, sorry, Dan, I just wanted to be careful.
I just think there's a lot of fear here, and in Ireland we are very afraid compared, you know, if you know people in other countries or foreigners who live here, we seem to be more fearful about COVID. And of course, it's a tragedy, it's a disaster. We wish it had never happened. But we do need to get it into perspective. And, you know, children... this is a discriminatory disease. It's elderly people that are really at risk from this. Mercifully, kids have not been anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Okay, Laura, briefly.
So I just wanted to come in on that because I actually, two of my nieces at the moment have COVID. And I was just comparing how I felt this time last year with seeing people, both adults and kids, getting COVID and being so fearful and frightened about what would happen to them. And we now see that, you know, COVID infections are cropping up in vaccinated people, like my brother, my sister-in-law. And I'm not one bit worried about them. I'm not worried about those children. I'm not worried about my brother. I'm not worried about his wife. I am a little bit worried about their in-laws who also have it, but they seem to be okay at the moment too. And that's a massive change to where we were this time last year. Yeah. So I think we need to be, you know, congratulate ourselves a little bit on how far we've come as
it. Yeah. And like it was always, wasn't it, that the profile of the disease will change. It will be less of a worry to get COVID. So you're actually saying we kind of are at that point with the vaccination and everything, that it is less of a worry.
But the response hasn't. Okay. I think as Rory O'Neill said yesterday, we're still using the sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Rather than we're trying to be a bit more, you know, a bit more finesse with, you know, we're trying rather than finesse the response.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Look, Dan, I just wanted to say to you about that under 14 thing. We were just acting out of an abundance
absolutely.
Of caution there.
Absolutely.
That I think somebody outside thought that possibly that was not correct.
Totally.
It does seem, as far as we know, it is. So I'm not questioning you or anything.
But you're absolutely right to question me. I could get it wrong.
Yeah. Okay. Now, we're going to take a call now from another angle on this, because there are other people suffering in different ways. Niamh Farrell from Ham Sandwich. Good morning.
Good morning, Brendan. Thanks for having me on.
And so, Niamh, you had a gig in Limerick last night. How was that?
We did. We played a gig in Dolan's in Limerick last night. And yeah, to be honest with you, it was quite bittersweet, really.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what's going to happen. You know, we don't know what's happening. We have no clue. We're waiting to hear from venues that we have gigs booked in for December and stuff. You know, obviously, they've been... you know, hit with another blow of not knowing what's happening, you know what I mean? And
in terms of those gigs for December, is there a way of doing a ham sandwich gig, which can be a raucous affair, I'm told. Is there a way of doing a ham sandwich gig under the new restrictions on gigs? Or are those tickets sold out? Are you going to have to say to half the people you can't come? What's happening around all that?
This is the problem now. It's like, logistically, it's an absolute nightmare for everybody. Anybody who has a sold out show in December. You know, I just don't see how these shows can go ahead anymore with the 50% capacity seated. You know, when you sold out a show, how do you decide who goes, if you do two shows a day, how do you decide who goes to the early or who goes to the late show? You know, logistically, how do the venues work that out? It's just, they've put us in a situation again where, without saying we're gonna shut everything down and put this proper supports in place, once again, it's, as somebody said earlier on, it's a wishy-washy 50%. And surely they know full well that that means gigs will be cancelled. You know what I mean? I just don't understand how they can look at that and go, oh no, the gigs will still be able to go ahead. They won't, quite frankly, you know?
Really, yeah. Yeah. So you think it should have been just like, for anyway, for the likes of you, look, some people are, with more theatre kind of shows possibly will be able to do it. But for people like you, they should have just said cancel gigs.
I think so. Like, you know what I mean? And I mean, it's devastating enough to have to go through this again, you know, for the industry. And, you know, feels a little bit like we're being used as a bit of a scapegoat now and again, you know. It's kind of like what we do is not important. What we do is a hobby, and it's not, you know, and it's just so disheartening. I mean, like, everybody in the industry over the last 2 years, you know, everybody's used music to make themselves feel better, art and theatre and everything like that. Do you know what I mean? And it, like, it brings, you know, it lifts people's souls. You know what I mean? It's like, it's something that we all need. You know what I mean? And it's just to have the rug pulled from under our feet again, you know. And I mean, it's not only the musicians.
Sorry, go on, finish.
It's not only the musicians. It's the backline techs, the sound engineers, the people who work behind the scenes, the people who, you know, the photographers that go, like, everybody I spoke to, their December calendar was filled to the brim with gigs and with work, you know.
So you, this was again, actually going to potentially keep you going for another while, having not worked much for the last 2 years. You were going to, like the pubs, you were going to have a great December, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. And the thing is, a lot of musicians and a lot of people in these situations, you know, December was always the busiest year. And, you know, that was where, you know, let's say we did a load of gigs and we made the money from the gigs, and then we put that money into recording an album. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that goes towards creating something else. You know what I mean?
Niamh, I saw Mary Coughlan on the news the other night and basically started crying and saying she'd basically probably thinking she'll just retire at this stage. Like, you must be on the floor, are you?
You know what? It's up and down. You know what I mean? It's up and down. The last 2 years, there's been bad moments and good moments. You know, I took it upon myself to kind of really make sure I looked after my mental health. I started doing yoga, meditation, and it actually, it really, really helped me, you know? And it takes all this uncertainty takes a toll on somebody's mental health. You know what I mean? It's not knowing what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's just so tough. And I just want to give a shout out to Minding Creative Minds, which is an initiative that was set up. Basically, it's sort of like a free therapy for musicians and for people in the industry. And they're online, and you can get in touch with them. And if anybody is out there, works in the music industry, and feels like they need to talk to somebody, please do. Okay. You know what I mean? We're not alone in this. Like, we are all, everybody in the industry, we're all in the same boat now. We all feel the same way. And, you know, it's going to be a tough December. But, you know, the thing about it, people in this industry, I think we're very resilient. Yeah. You know what I mean? Okay. And I mean, that doesn't mean like we deserve to be treated like this. You know what I mean?
But at the end of the day, I think you'll get back up again.
We will, absolutely.
Yeah. Niamh Farrell from Ham Sandwich. Look, the best of luck to you and the band and to all your colleagues in music. There it is. It's a tough old time. Laura, you were saying there about last year versus this year and the feelings around COVID. I'm interested in, I know you're not back on the factory floor yet, so to speak, but you went off on maternity leave when?
I went off in March. So this time last year, so last Christmas, I was doing, I was covering call over Christmas, which was a general medical call. You take everything that comes in the door, the COVID admissions, the reviews on the wards. And so last year I did Stevens's Day. We all take a day or a couple of days over Christmas on any general medical rota. And I remember I was so anxious. I was really anxious to do a good job. I was really anxious that I would take good care of people. But I was really worried about myself. And I suppose I was making the choice to be there. I could have tapped out and sat at home, but I wanted to do my bit.
And nobody had any vaccination.
We weren't vaccinated. I'd seen lots of really sick young people. And COVID is really weird, Brendan. Usually when you're on the wards and you look after a sick person and they're deteriorating, they tend to kind of dwindle a little bit, so that when somebody needs to be, say, intubated or have respiratory kind of, they tend to be a little bit out of it. But COVID was really different for all of us because and it still is, because COVID, when they deteriorate, they are fully wide awake. They're having a conversation with you while they tank. And it was the first, it was my first kind of that around that time, my first experiences of that, where you had to have conversations with people about the fact that they were going to be intubated and go to the ICU.
So these are people who are droning alive, basically, but are fully aware of what's going on.
They're fully with it, and they're sending texts to their loved ones, and they're with it. And you have to have a, like, usually this sounds terrible, but usually somebody is kind of goes down, tanks a little bit, but they're kind of either asleep or a bit out of it. And you go, you do everything that needs to be done, but there's less conversation. But these were like young, fit, otherwise previously healthy people sitting bolt upright in the bed, unable to breathe, but staring you in the eyes while you told them, I'm going to have to call ICU and I think somebody's going to have a look at you about going to the unit.
Right. And then how different is it now?
So, but this is what they, now the unvaccinated, it's exactly the same disease. So that's what you see in unvaccinated people. Mm. In the vaccinated people, we're not, it's not that severe fulminant COVID pneumonitis that we're seeing for the most part, I'm told. But this time last year was a really traumatizing time for everybody. At this stage, it had been, we were hearing chinks of light about vaccination coming from the States. We were dying to get it into us. But it was a very different time. And the people were terrified. Like, you know, there were people who were washing their fruit in the supermarkets. And we forget that, you know, there was, and we have come an awful long way, even though, like, this is all terrible and the variant is awful. But I'm still, it's a completely different world to where we were at this time last year.
And look, we can tend to have a very negative narrative around it, but in the scheme of things, we are in a different place. Gerald Barry, before you go, can I ask you, the question everybody wants to know, and I know you don't have an answer to it, but we'll just get your opinion on it. When will we know about Omicron, and when will we know have a good idea of how much of a threat it is?
I think there's going to be a few different stages to it. I think laboratory experiments results may even start coming out later this week.
And that'll be vaccine breakthrough results, will it?
No, that'll be really just basically what they'll do is they'll take blood from vaccinated patients or previously infected patients, and they'll mix it with the virus, and they'll just check to see whether antibodies are able to neutralise it or not. That gives you a preliminary insight into it. I think the other two key things will be tracking obviously what happens in South Africa, but probably more importantly tracking what happens in somewhere like Europe, which would be more comparable in terms of levels of vaccination in our country.
That really, Oslo restaurant is kind of freaking me out. Would you agree? Now, they don't have 80 to 100 cases out of it yet, but they're expecting out of 120 people in a restaurant, it seems, not all of whom are at the same party, that 80 to 100 of them could have it.
Yes, yeah. And so, it's those kind of stories, you know, and I think it's lovely to hear the other doctor that's contributing there, because it is a completely different picture. We have to admit that. And we're in a much better place this year than we were last year.
Yeah.
But I suppose all I would say is that I think we just need to plan in a much better way on the long term for the what if. What if the third booster shot doesn't protect against this variant? Brilliant if it does, because it's already having a huge impact against Delta. But what if it doesn't? What are we going to do? And I'd love to have those kind of meetings at a government level to put proper plans in place and say, we're not going to, well, we're going to think about tomorrow, but we're also going to think about the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
Well, how can we set up our country to deal with that?
I think they are having those meetings, and
I hope so.
The Tánaiste did say that they're planning already for next winter. All right, Gerald Barry, thank you very much. Daniel McConnell, Laura Durkin and Dan O'Brien are staying with us. Let's take a break, and let's take a break from COVID.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Just want to note before we move on, there's a lot of texts that are very supportive of Neffet and very supportive of Tony Holohan. And indeed, that poll that was in the Sunday Independent today, would bear that out, wouldn't it? That there's more support for Neffet still than there is for the government.
Which
is
a finding which a lot of ministers are very aware of.
Now, listen, let's take ourselves out. Let's get some, stand back and get some perspective, because we're all only here for a short time, and there's a big river of history going along that we only dip into. And Danny, you are noticing, I think it's Colm Kenny has been
Colm Kenny's very interesting piece
in the Sunday Independent Treaty.
So tomorrow marks the 100th anniversary of the signing of the treaty in Downing Street. And obviously, why was it signed? How it was signed? The ramifications of all of it? You know, talk of splits between government and Neffet. We had splits between De Valera and Collins and Griffith. And what I suppose we've there's been a couple of very interesting. Colm Kenny has a very interesting new book.
Yeah, I'm learning stuff. Those columns every 2 weeks, you learn kind of new things that go completely against the simplified version we were taught.
Yeah, and we have a package in our own paper tomorrow about the tree, and I've written a piece about the sort of behind the scenes of the negotiations.
Yeah,
and like they went over having not, I suppose, the Irish had went over without, I suppose, figuring out what their bottom line was. Which allowed David Lloyd George exploit and kind of open up the split between the Collins and Griffith side of the delegation, who were probably more more amenable to a settlement or a negotiation, and the hardliners, who were very much like, we can't give up on the Republic at all in any way. And ultimately, this big row of should the delegation, when Lloyd George famously on the night of the 5th of December got up and waved two letters and said, I need to communicate with James Craig tonight. Is it peace or war for your country? Terrible and immediate war, but in 3 days, essentially. And they blinked, the Irish blinked and signed the treaty in London. They should have. They were under orders to essentially refer it back to Dublin before.
I thought Colm Kenny was saying today though it had to go by the Dáil or something, did it? Or was there? That it's more complicated.
It is more
think.
Complicated, yeah. But there is essentially they left. There was a cabinet meeting a couple of days beforehand in which they had essentially tried to move the goalpost and try to blame Ulster if the talks were likely to break down, because they were always on the verge of breaking down. But there was this sort of tacit instruction, try and get it back to a position that you have to refer back to Dublin. Griffith said, I will sign, but I may need to get it back to, sign it back for cabinet and Dáil approval. The British weren't wearing that, so ultimately the delegation signed. It obviously then was subject to, pretty emotive and lengthy debates in the Dáil over Christmas.
Yeah.
And ultimately it was ratified by a margin of 64 to 57. But there are a couple of key decisions that have haunted that period. Why did De Valera not go to London? Why did the team captain stay at home?
Because he was too smart.
Well, he probably was. But why then did Griffith allow himself get tied up to this agreement around a boundary commission, tacitly accepting the principle of partition, and then not willing to break on that when others probably wanted to break on the
because
issue?
Because they thought ultimately though that the partition would make Northern Ireland
economically unviable. Yeah, but ultimately there was too much stock. I think Lloyd George did a good job in sort of beefing up the principle of this idea of a boundary commission, which ultimately was a bit of an
And of course the rest, as they say, is history.
Of
course, if there had been more transparency in social media and radio programmes back then, they wouldn't have got away with all that at all. Things would have been very different. And Dan, we cannot, boats beating back against the tide, we can't get away from our history. So Leo Varadkar, amongst his many other issues at the moment, is also, John Drennan's writing in the Mail today, keeping an eye on Fine Gael's legacy.
Yep, that piece by John Drennan about how the centenaries will be dealt with. And just a wider thing, one of the best books I've read over the past 5 years is a book called In Praise of Forgetting. Very interesting American writer, David Reif, R-I-E-F-F, argues that instead of healing wounds, commemoration can actually reopen them. And instead of
what's going on around here,
this cliche that if those who forget history are condemned to repeat it, there's no evidence for that. That's absolute. That's a cliche that actually has no evidence. And that he says, we need to be careful about over commemoration because it only opens up old wounds. And I think recent things that we've seen in this country may prove that. And I would be slightly fearful for the next year as we move through the Civil War commemoration period.
But it could be even noted, Brendan, if you look at the Irish and British response to marking the treaty, given what happened in Armagh around the present non-attendance and various other matters in relation to Article 16, it's a very low-key event, whereas you probably would have seen maybe a bilateral between Boris Johnson and Micheál Martin on another day if things had been different. Mm. But it's a very low-key, very understated. I think there might be a statement from a British minister, low-level, to kind of maybe half remember it, but there's none of the significance of what essentially was the partition of Ireland formally. I don't know if the Government of Ireland Act had happened, but ultimately this cemented it, and obviously the legacy of that came, that tells a lot of how nervous and they are after the RIC debacle last year at Fine Gael, and obviously the recent events in Armagh.
You'd wonder, Laura, do politicians care more about this and care more passionately than most people? Like that you have people in Fine Gael freaking out at the notion that a Fianna Fáil government might be unveiling a statue of Michael Collins and all this. Like, you'd wonder, is that on a lot of people's minds?
No.
There you go. There you go. Dan, we have a couple of minutes left and I did want to ask you, have a very big, your kind of semi-regular economic roundup in the Business Post today. And I would say you're being cautiously optimistic for a dismal scientist, are you?
Well, unfortunately, it's very difficult to do economics at the moment, but certainly about the future, because there is such an incredible, I've never experienced this sort of uncertainty. We could have runaway inflation. We could have a renewed recession. There is just so many possibilities out there that can't be ruled out. But generally, certainly over the past 2 weeks or so, we've had lots of good news. So that's it's been pretty good. And the way people and businesses and organizations have adapted to this has just been incredible. And in Ireland, elsewhere. So that's, you know, very positive. Some sectors are doing really well, the tech sector. Now, you know, we know that the nighttime economy, the entertainment economy is absolutely suffering. That's a really big worry. We know that 300,000 jobs are still being subsidized and that hasn't really changed. So we've had some very good stuff in terms of jobs, but there is a concern there that all of those subsidies are keeping jobs going. Will that be sustainable? Is that going to continue? Is there going to be, you know, a jobs shock in the industries that are most affected by this? And then there's the elephant in the room, which probably doesn't get talked about that much, is that all of the government spending that is being able to keep things going is effectively being backstopped by the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, which is printing vast amounts of money. That's not going to go on forever. And there will be a sort of reckoning as to, you know, did we overspend? What position are we in with our national debt? And that's, you know, that's probably coming down the line next year. Maybe they'll kick the can down the road. But, you know, there is that. That's something that we really do need to keep an eye on.
So do you think, is the boom going to keep getting boomier for another while? Or do you see a sharp correction coming from some black swan situation?
I don't know.
Yeah.
The honest answer. Things are just so uncertain now. It's certainly the recovery, the bounce back has been stronger than I would have thought. And that's great. And I hope that continues.
Yeah.
But, you know, whether it's to do with the variant, whether it's to do with, you know, inflation getting too high, there are a lot of uncertainties out there.
OK, Dan O'Brien, thank you very much. And thank you, Daniel McConnell and Laura Durkin. That was excellent. Thanks, guys.